we are not what's actually normal out there, but we treat it as such. And one of the things that we have in our real culture when it comes to kids is the idea that waking is a problem, that babies should be sleeping independently, that they should be sleeping long stretches on their own, that we need to teach them to sleep, that we need to have, you know, routines and structures and everything that create this optimal sleep environment. And that's just not really how it is elsewhere.
You're listening to the Untaming Podcast.
Rewild the Child.
Here is your host, Emily Giles.
Hi, I'm Emily. Welcome back to the Untaming Podcast. Today it is the last quarter of the Hunger Moon here in the Southern Hemisphere. I hope you enjoyed the range of topics that Natasha Tucker and I covered last week. I was so impressed with her ability to tie many of the topics we covered, like grief and civilization and trans folk and homeschooling, all into a neat little metaphor from the natural world. In the next episode, I will be chatting with Dr. Diana Cortez, a functional dentist. So we covered a lot of topics related to oral health and nutrition. But today we have our guest host, Mary Fran Selbeck, with an interview she recorded with Tracy Castles. Enjoy.
Welcome again to the Untaming Podcast. I am your occasional guest host, Mary Francel, IBCLC. I blog at www.whatdobabiesneed.com. I'm also the administrator of and founder of Biologically Normal Infant and Toddler Sleep on Facebook. And I have a private practice, lactation practice in Bellingham, Washington in the U.S. And I am thrilled today to welcome my guest, Tracy Castles, PhD, who is just somebody I've admired from a distance for a long time. She has some wonderful articles on her website, a fantastic podcast, and we'll talk a little bit more about that. But welcome, Tracy. Thank you for joining me.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Wonderful. Well, I'm going to do a brief introduction of Tracy. Tracy Castles, PhD, is the director of Evolutionary Parenting, a resource she founded in 2011 after the birth of her daughter, Maddie. It began whilst she was in graduate school and has continued and grown as she completed her PhD and moved towards more direct work with parents and families. She has a BA in cognitive science from the University of California, Berkeley, an MA in clinical psychology from the University of British Columbia, and a PhD in developmental psychology, also from the University of British Columbia. The focus of her dissertation work was on empathy and theory of mind in young children. Her academic works have been published in peer-reviewed journals, including Psychological Assessment, PLOS-1, Personality and Individual Differences, Midwifery, and more. Tracy serves as an advisor to the Children's Health and Human Rights Partnership, a nonprofit agency dedicated to ending routine infant circumcision. She has previously worked in the nonprofit sector in agencies focused on education and/or social and emotional development. Tracy is married to Brian and is mother to two young kids and a stepmother to one older kid. She lives in a small town in Prince Edward County, Ontario, Canada. Tracy Castles hosts the Evolutionary Parenting Podcast, and you can find a wealth of information and resources on her website, evolutionaryparenting.com. Her most recent scholarly article with Dr. Levita D'Souza is titled Contextual Considerations in Infant Sleep, Offering Alternative Interventions to Families. Last night, she got 6 hours of sleep, and for lunch today, she had scrambled eggs and tomato. Tracy, I just really, really love your podcast. I've especially enjoyed the most recent episode, or one of your more recent episodes with the author of We're Here, Becoming an LGBTQ Parent. And I just recently also listened to the one on couples entering into parenthood by someone who does the John Gottman program. I think it's called Bringing Baby Home, which is focused on how parents adjust to becoming parents and how it affects their relationship as a couple. So anyway, I just really love all of the work that you do. I share your articles on my Facebook group all the time. So I'd like to start out with asking, first of all, why you named your website and podcast Evolutionary Parenting, and how did you become interested in that subject?
So it actually started a while ago, right at the very beginning, and the name came throughout discussions with my husband. I was, you know, looking at the research as we were going back to stuff, seeing how much it didn't match what we were talking about in our culture about parenting and birth and everything. And it just was the name that came to me as like trying to describe the practices and the history from this evolutionary perspective of we can't just look at what we do in our culture, in our time, without considering that our babies are little evolutionary creatures that are carrying hundreds of thousands of years of innate lessons that we've taken throughout, and that more so than what our culture currently believes has a more profound impact on their behavior, how they respond to the world, what they expect of the world. And that is kind of what it came from. So I was just chatting with him and he just said, "Wait, is that like your term?" I'm like, "Well, I haven't seen it, and that's just what I call it." He's like, "Okay, you're taking that. That is what you do." I'd had the site at the time, and I can't even remember what it was called before that, but it was just like a little blog, kind of, it was getting my writing out. And so we immediately changed it, and that was what it was. And so obviously, when I did the podcast, just under the same thing, it is encompassing that same idea of taking a look at our evolutionary history through a variety of lenses, whether it be anthropology, neuroscience, et cetera, and professionals, because I also interview other professionals who share a similar lens in how they approach working with families.
Absolutely. And I remember Dr. James McKenna saying that, you know, our infants have not evolved to match our culture. And so I think this is such an important topic to really understand where our babies are when they're born. They're not coming out expecting Western cultural values.
Exactly. They have a set of expectations that are to meet their biological needs. And we are not in a culture that does that a lot of the time. And because it's hard for parents too, I never want to be like, we're just all a bunch of selfish assholes. We're not. That's not what's happening. We are stressed because we're in a culture that demands so much of us, and we lack the support, and we lack the kind of family unit and other units that can help us support our babies. It's, you know, you have the circular view of, you know, you put a child at the center and the parents around. Well, you need those other layers of that circle surrounding them to support inward, and we don't have it. So parents are stuck making decisions that they otherwise wouldn't have to make.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So in your recent article, you discuss the cultural disconnect between how many Western parents think infants and toddlers should sleep, which is, of course, a big topic of interest to me and to you as well, I know, and also then how they actually do sleep. So can you talk about why parents often, you know, especially in Western cultures, often perceive normal infant sleep as a problem?
Yeah. So this really just comes down to, I think, expectations. It's the biggest idea. When you have a child in, we call it the weird cultures, right? This is that terminology that came about actually from UBC, from researchers that while I was there, Western educated, industrialized, rich, and democratic countries. And just a bit of a background, because I think it's important. For the longest time, a lot of research, particularly in psychology, but also economics and other fields, treated findings that were always done in these particular cultures as being universal. We would see similar behaviors amongst people, whether it was the UK or the US or Australia or Canada. And we then said, oh, this is a universal. This is what all human beings do. And Joe Heinrich was one of the first to go to other small scale societies and non-weird cultures and test just some of these economic games. What do they do? Is this universal? And obviously what he found is that it's not at all. It is, they behave completely differently. And when we look at that, we actually find, because we are still somewhat a minority as being weird cultures, most cultures in the world are not weird in this way. We are not the dominant view. We are not what's actually normal out there, but we treat it as such. And one of the things that we have in our real culture when it comes to kids is the idea that waking is a problem, that babies should be sleeping independently, that they should be sleeping long stretches on their own, that we need to teach them to sleep, that we need to have, you know, routines and structures and everything that create this optimal sleep environment. And that's just not really how it is elsewhere. And so if you are in a culture where you believe, okay, my baby should not be waking at night, or my toddler should not be waking at night, that they need to fall asleep on their own, apart from everyone else, and they need to do this without fuss, without complaint, without everything. When you're handed a baby who wakes regularly throughout the night, who requires contact and comfort from a caregiver to fall back to sleep at night, you see this as a problem. And many families think it's now them doing something wrong. And that's an idea we reinforce with families. When people go to doctors or friends or other family and they say, this is what's going on, most people will then say, oh, well, you've made a rod for your own back, or, oh, well, really what you need to do is, as we all sleep train, is what we go to, is leave them to cry and they'll just learn you don't come and then they'll sleep. And it's, but that's not, you know, I have another paper that just came out actually as well this year that looks at, does sleep training actually result in longer sleep stretches with infants based on the studies that are out there? And no, it doesn't. They don't sleep any better. They don't call out, and that's a different thing. And so I think it's really just about the expectations that we place in our society. The second bit, though, I think, is we are not, again, going back to that idea of a family-friendly society. So yes, if your sleep is disrupted constantly and you're expected to get up and go work an 8-hour day away from your baby, and you're expected to take care of the house and do this and that and the other, it does become a problem. What is normal for everyone else is suddenly very difficult to do because the expectations placed on the family and the lack of support surrounding it make what is normal harder. So I think it's really like we get the combination of both of those that are going into play here.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. And I really love the quiz on your website that helps parents distinguish between a perceived sleep problem, because so many of these are a cultural expectation that makes it a problem, and an actual sleep problem. So what are some actual health concerns that could cause sleep issues? And so how can parents distinguish those?
Yeah, and that's a really good question. And it's one that, you know, there, I have it up there as a screening tool, just because as any screening tool, you may be more or less likely to flag. It's not 100%. It's not going to tell everyone exactly what's going on. But through work with IBCLCs as yourself and other professionals, I've been able to see some of the things that do impact sleep, and then with families, be able to work on them, or send them off to the right people to work on them with. And so the few things that regularly come up, one is dietary issues, whether it's food intolerances, allergies, et cetera. There's a hard, food intolerances is something that particularly in our Western culture, we don't always accept as something. And I often have spoken to nutritionists who do work on food intolerances with families. So very much do view it as, yes, this is a real thing that happens. But I think one of the issues for people there is that food intolerances in babies can just be transient, right? Because they're developing a whole microbiome. They don't have certain enzymes to help digest certain foods. And so it's really, you know, common to have more gas, more struggles to digest foods when you don't have what's needed to do that. So oftentimes when families report very uncomfortable wakings with their babies are very squirmy or gassy all the time, where they can't get comfortable and settle at night, they seem to stay in this lighter sleep for the whole night. They do have a large chunk of lighter sleep compared to adults, but that whole lighter sleep, that is when I will often say, you know what, do you have a nutritionist you can talk to? Do you have someone you're comfortable going to talk this through? Obviously, with that as well, if there's rashes or really bad diaper rash, when people see, you know, my kids had allergies and my daughter was, luckily, they figured it out at about day 5 because of the symptoms were so strong. She had a very, very red bump, not like the cheeks, but the anus, the opening was very red. And it was our midwife who's like, there's something not right here. And then blood in the stools is a big flag, mucus in the stools. So all of those things kind of come together to say, okay, dietary might be an issue. And that can come up more with especially kids who are using formula, because dairy can be very hard for them to digest, and that can be a difficult thing. So sometimes that's a hard part. Another thing is breathing disorders. And I had an ENT on the podcast to talk about why they were so important to identify and how to identify them in kids. But apneas, where you hear this, you know, stopping breathing for periods and then sudden intakes or waking with that, snoring, sleeping regularly with a mouth open and mouth breathing all the time. These are all problems that should be dealt with as quickly as possible, which sometimes isn't always as quickly as possible given ages, but certainly be looked at and can definitely impact sleep. Because as we all know, people who snore do not sleep well. They struggle to get into deeper sleep. They can't, you know, they can't arouse properly. And so it might be sudden and then scary and difficult to go back down. So that's one of the things that can come up regularly for families. I'm trying to think here, what are some of the other big ones? Because then there's the real random small things that go. But even in that, I talk about stuff like teething. You know, there's mixed research. It's hard to find research that's conclusive on teething because kids are different. Some kids' pain thresholds are different. Some kids, when they teeth molars, all four come in a month, and others will have this protracted molar teething of, you know, 6 months or something. So I think that's something that's really difficult for research to ascertain, but we do see that popping up. So there can be pain, illness. Any illness is going to, as everyone knows, affect sleep. If your baby's sick, and this goes back to the breathing, most of the times babies don't sleep well because they're stuffy and can't breathe properly. Again, if that's regularly happening, stuffiness or snoring, it's like having an ongoingly sick baby. So these are just some of the things that really crop up. Oh, and feeding difficulties. Of course, I'm talking to an IBCLC. That is a huge area where if there's latch problems, if there's supply issues or just getting comfortable with it, I don't know all the different ones, but I am regularly sending people off to IBCLCs to have stuff looked at if it seems that there is a feeding problem of, you know, not too frequent feeding. And it's hard to say that because it can be very normal for babies to feed quite regularly. But I always say if it feels like too much and you can't even get a 40-minute stretch of sleep, you might want to talk to someone. And I think it's always good to have that kind of problem assessed.
Absolutely. And the other one that comes to mind is a nutritional deficiency, like anemia yeah. or magnesium deficiency might yeah. be also making children more restless.
Absolutely. Yeah. There's lots that can crop up in that as well. And that kind of goes back to the nutritionist talking about getting whatever supplement is needed and doing it in the most healthy way.
Absolutely. So you mentioned before that when a baby or child doesn't conform to Western cultural notions of where and how they may sleep, parents are often told to sleep train, and it usually takes some form of extinction training or cry it out, whether it's the camping out or just shutting the door and letting the baby cry. So, but you know, parents, as you mentioned, are just often just desperate for rest. So what are some alternatives that parents can use to help the whole family get enough rest?
So I know it's controversial in Western cultures, but I will say
families, podcast.
Probably not though. There you go. But I am a huge advocate of co-sleeping when it works for the family. And I say co-sleeping to mean both room sharing or bed sharing as it goes. That is, Helen Ball has wonderful research looking at the perception of how people sleep when they bed share. And in this case, it is specifically bed sharing, but women report getting more sleep. They report, and the research was done with women, so I'm not speaking to men in this because that was not the study population, but they report sleeping better. They report that they feel more rested, even if their babies are waking the same amount. But it's very different to be able to settle a baby right away without them getting worked up. And that's one of the things, and babies want close proximity to us. When we think again from this evolutionary framework, babies are there to survive. And they know at an innate level, we're not talking about a conscious level here, but they know they're vulnerable because they can't move for themselves. Even toddlers are vulnerable. They can't take care of themselves out in the wild. They require someone else to take care of them. And our evolutionary history has been that if you are on your own, you are not, you're not going to survive. You're not going to be well. And nighttime is inherently scary. And I always love Sebastian Younger, who's an author. He has talked on podcasts before, and I love this take of it, that if you go camping in the backwoods out somewhere, would you put your baby or toddler or even child at that point in a separate tent alone away from you? And I don't know anyone that would, because that is a horrifying thought that you wouldn't be able to be there if you know there's grizzly bears around or whatnot, like, and they cry, who's going to get them? And if they cried and you knew there were grizzly bears around, would you feel comfortable? What would that do? And that's the kind of evolutionary framework that our babies come with. That kind of, that's their baggage, for lack of a better term. It's their knowledge. It's their wisdom as to how to stay alive. But in our culture, it's a bit of their baggage as to what they need going forward. And you can't just take that out of them. You can't just train it out of them. And so anything that brings that proximity to them and that comforting to go to them is, so being there at bedtime, having that responsive period right before bed, even if your baby isn't sleeping with you, can help keep them feel safe as they go in. And that was the term uspavani, I love, was a podcast I did with, and that's a Czech term for the process of being there with your child as they go into this sleep world. And the idea behind it is, you know, in Czech culture, it's very common to believe that children need that really supportive presence at bedtime so that when they journey into the sleep world of dreams, that's how they have good dreams. That's how you have good sleep, is if you don't have that supportive, comforting time right before bed, you won't have the good overnight sleep. So depending on the age of kids, sometimes just being there at bedtime can be good enough for them. But certainly proximity, sometimes it can be fine to introduce overlapping cues that help kids feel safe without it always having to be you. So people have success with, and it's very variable, but success with sound machines or, you know, swaddling for younger babies that aren't rolling over, things like that, that can offer some level of support. But I'll be quite honest, it's finding the way that you can be the most responsive and present that often helps babies the most. And of course, looking at all those things we just talked about, because, you know, a lot of families where I see really bad sleep, you know, where, you know, I've had families contact me because their baby is waking up approximately 20 to 30 times a night. And that is excessive. I'm going to come right out and say, if that's you. And when we've been able to identify what's wrong and it goes into the realm of normal of, you know, 2-3 times a night, or sometimes depending on the age, up to 4-5 times a night, it suddenly feels like the whole world is better. The rose-colored glasses come back on, you get everything. So there's that. The other thing is prioritizing your own sleep. And this is, you know, I know we love that idea of put your kids to bed, go up, watch a show, have your time. But sometimes you need to just go to bed too. And if it's, or go to bed early enough that you're making sure you get enough sleep. If you can get support sleeping in, some people find they feel more rested if someone else gets up early with baby, if baby happens to be an earlier, whatever early is, and you get 2-3 hours sleep right before starting your day, kind of just to yourself, that can make a massive difference. I always recommend take one day a week to sleep in if you can. If you have to work and everything and you have a partner or a parent or a friend that can come in the morning on a weekend and take your child for a bit. Kids are often, especially younger kids, more amenable to being with others when they're not tired and exhausted. So trying to get someone to do nighttime is hard. Getting someone to come play in the morning, kids are often much more open to that experience. And that really helps them have that with someone, they get the experience of someone else, and you can take that time to go sleep.
Yeah, absolutely. I love that. And I, you know, that is something also that you hear a lot of, that, oh, my baby only will go to sleep for me. They won't go to sleep for my partner. And it's so exhausting. I have to do it all the time. And I say, well, you know, are you doing it together? Are you making little steps? Like, are you just like handing the child over and expecting them to go to sleep with another person? You know, try maybe doing it together for a while. Get the child used to doing it with both of you, and then they'll feel safe. And, you know, eventually you can start leaving for longer and longer times, but folks tend to want to just do, like, you know, all or nothing. So it's, you don't think about these things sometimes when you're sleep, you know, deprived and exhausted.
Exactly. And I will reiterate that whole, I always say, break down what you want to have happen into multiple small steps. So if it's, you know, 5 steps, what do we do first? And how do we work a partner in to just be there at the beginning, and then maybe take over just the first step of the routine? And then you come in, and then the second step. And it just becomes these small gradual transitions. And I think people forget too, and it's a really important thing to consider. Babies and toddlers learn from repeated exposures, but they need a lot of repeated exposures. If you think about as an adult, we have the cognitive capacity to be exposed to something a couple times, and then we're able to kind of integrate it. Sometimes not. Think about habits that it takes us time to learn as well. But for babies, because they don't have that cognitive ability to say, oh, it's grandma putting me to sleep, it's dad putting me to sleep, it's mama putting me to sleep, that means that they just see it as different. It's not necessarily as safe. And they need to experience that safety, the bit of, oh my God, what's happening, followed by safety, over and over and over and over and over and over and over again, before they can feel comfortable. And other cultures, you know, when we look at some of these smaller band hunter-gatherer societies, are really good about incorporating lots of back and forth with kids. So we don't see stranger danger in some of these cultures. It's a really fascinating kind of, it's a Western phenomenon in many ways. And part of it is that these kids, they are passed around people all the time, but it's small doses. So I know Darsha Narvez was on the podcast talking about one of the cultures she went to see, where every night the babies are passed around the circle from all the adults back again. And it takes, you're talking just a few minutes, but that act of seeing the same faces every day, of being held, and then it's probably somewhat anxiety producing for that child, because what's happening? But it's short enough that it's not scary, and it ends with being back in the safety of mom's arms. And that's the kind of stress that is positive, that helps us learn, because it's small, it's short, and it ends with that safety. So over time, that baby goes around and around and around, people are great. Or another practice that I know I've read in many cultures is babies get passed around to other people all throughout the day, but they're only with that person for as long as they're comfortable with. So if they cry within 5 minutes, that person's handing them back to mom. And then they calm down, then they go off to someone else, and maybe they last 10 minutes or 2 minutes, and then they're back to mom. But every time they have that experience of separation and reunification, they then get that safety again. So sometimes we have to remember that when we're incorporating this with any change with caregivers and whatnot, we need that constant repetition of a bit of separation and reunification again, over and over, and short, short doses that then become comfortable to expand as kids can go longer, because they now believe, oh, I'm safe here. It's fine. I know if I cry, mom, I get brought to mom, or, you know, mom is there, whoever that primary caregiver is. And that's what's so important.
I love that. And that, I think that's very applicable also to daycare situations as well. You know, we just expect to just drop our kids off and have them be fine. And often they need a lot of introduction, a lot of back and forth, and it's not always possible, but, you know, that might be something that, you know, maternity leave, as short as we have, could partly be used to, or, you know, having the parent drop in, you know, from time to time, just so that the child feels safe, especially if they're older, because when they're little, they sometimes don't really know who the person is. I also wanted to talk to you a little bit, because there is, I think, in our culture, a reliance often on, like, things to do to get children to do things. you know, like rituals, like a bedtime ritual. That's going, if I come up with this great bedtime ritual, I am going to be able to get my child to sleep. I do this, this, and this, and then they're asleep. You know, rather than it being, you know, the connection or with the parent. So I really love the article you have on your website about helping sleep resistors fall asleep. And I often share that in my Facebook group. So many parents get frustrated with these long bedtime rituals, and then the children just won't go to sleep. So can you share a little bit from that article, some ideas that parents can kind of rethink about how bedtime works or even nap time works?
Absolutely. And I'll start by saying that sleep resistance, there's multiple ways at which it can come out. There's the biological way, which is that melatonin levels aren't high enough. And there's good research on that, that when we see, especially toddlers who are very much resisting sleep, they're often not physiologically ready for sleep. And that's always one of the biggest things to consider, is that, am I even getting the right time? We are not little robots that we can send through a series of things and then we go to sleep. We have to be tired enough. We have to have melatonin levels that are high enough. And we have to be psychologically ready to go to bed as well. So when we think about that, I always start with the biological. Is your child tired enough? And were they active enough outside? Did they get enough outside time? We know that being outdoors is crucial to helping us regulate our circadian rhythm, to helping us feel more tired. Fresh air actually does tire us out by the end of the day, which is a wonderful thing. So what are these things that need to get to that stage? And then with melatonin, it is also, is your child in dark enough light? And one of the things that I always highlight, it is fascinating to me looking at the research on melatonin, how children are far more affected by light than adults are. So we talk about how lights can disrupt our sleep. If you have lights on too bright before bed, if you have lights in the bedroom going on, all those things can impact our sleep because it suppresses melatonin production, which is what's needed not only to fall asleep, but it also helps us stay asleep. Like having high enough levels helps us consolidate that sleep when our sleep pressure wanes. And kids are much more affected by it. So in one study, they looked at adults. So the study protocol, I always say this has to be the world's most boring study to take part in for child or adult, but you have the midday, the researchers come in, they block all light. So it becomes pitch black basically for an hour. They might have a little bit kind of the equivalent of like a nightlight on to do activities. And you sit in that for 50 minutes. Then they open up and they measure your melatonin levels. So they measure them at the start, after 50 minutes in the dark, they put you back in the light for 50 minutes, measure it again, and then back in the dark for another 50 minutes and measure it again. So if you've tolerated all of that, and with kids, they have this weird light game that they play in the dark for it and everything. And so they are engaged. What they find with adults is that your melatonin levels are suppressed when you start. They're low because you've been in daylight. They should be. They rise rapidly during that first bit in the dark. And then when you're exposed to light, they drop again, but they drop about 30%. So, which is significant when we think about it, right? Like that 50 minutes drops. But then the other interesting part is then when you're re-exposed to darkness again, they actually rise much slower than they did that first time. It's a very slow build as it goes up. And with kids, it's the same pattern, except two notable differences. One, approximately 10% of kids show complete suppression just from that tiny bit of light that's on in the dark, that kind of little bit of nightlight. They do it in lux, but it's such a small amount. They don't even get a rise in melatonin. It is that suppressed by it. The second bit that's interesting is that their drop is not 30%. It's 80 to 90% of their melatonin drops again. And then it's slow build going up. So this is all to say that when we look at that research, we know children are far more affected by light exposure. And when we think about our homes, it means even having that light, that ceiling light on, especially with LEDs, which actually suppress melatonin more than our old school light bulbs. And most of us have LEDs for good reason, for the environment. I'm not talking against them, but it means we may actually be inadvertently making it even harder for our kids to fall asleep at a physiological level. So I always start with families saying, look at the amount of time they're outside each day, how much activity they're getting, what does all this look like? And then you can go to the psychological. And I also, before that, let me just clarify one more thing about the biological, which is that the other problem I think families have is that they expect it to be the same every day. And it's not. Every day, there's a wake or a sleep window that we have, because when you have a fully functioning circadian rhythm, you are going to fall asleep at similar times if you're waking up at the same time each day and you're getting that activity. But you think about a day where I live in Canada. Sometimes in winter, it's 40 below and it's cold and we do not get out very much because it is just not happening. Those days are going to be harder to fall asleep because we're just not active. We're not out there. We're not getting that fresh air. We're not outside enough. In summer, it can sometimes be easier. The kids can spend hours outdoors and then be okay to come in and just conk out. It takes them 5 minutes to fall asleep as opposed to later. So that's one of those things to always remember, is to think about it in terms of a window, not some set time where they have to be asleep by 8:30, 9, whatever that is. That's not how it works. But then we have to get to the whole notion of psychology.
Before on to that, though, I do want to also mention, while we're on the subject of light, that a lot of times folks also tend to want to just bring their child into a dark room and boom, they're asleep, you know, or you know, you do all this bedtime ritual stuff with all the lights on, and then you expect them to go right to sleep, you know. Yeah. And it starts even before you start any kind of bedtime ritual, with slowly dimming the lights and making things calm in the home. It takes them a while to get to that point. So I think that's an important thing to remember as well.
Well, and actually I will add, because I know the calm is a thing that works for some kids, but some actually get more hyper right before bed. And there's kind of this big conception that, oh, they're overtired. And sometimes they are. But actually, in a lot of cases, we all have a period right before we go to sleep. And our cortisol levels rise a bit, along with a bunch of other hormones. So the pineal gland is what keeps us awake. As our sleep pressure gets higher, the pineal gland counters it by releasing hormones that keep us kind of, so that we don't just fall asleep every time our sleep pressure rises. But at the end of the day, when our sleep pressure is at its highest, we can feel really tired. You know, we kind of get this, oh, and then the pineal gland has a final burst. And I love, Harvard Sleep Center calls it the hour of forbidden sleep. And adults, it doesn't matter. I mean, basically, it takes extreme measures for people to be able to fall asleep during that time. And I know a lot of people will hear this and suddenly go, oh, I always thought I was getting a second wind at that time. And the problem is, because we don't know about it, we get these feelings. And as adults, we often do the exact opposite of what we should do. Oh, I might start doing some more work. I might start doing this. Our brain gets active again and we turn on more lights and we do more stuff and we create kind of a vicious cycle. But our kids can get that energy. And that energy burst can be, they need to move, because they're just kind of flooded with these hormones keeping them up, and they need to move to get them out, but they don't need to move in the light. They don't need to move, you know. You can have that dim environment. I always say, keep kind of what you said, the environment to be that calm and everything, but you can't force a child into that state. And that's often what I see families doing, is no, it's not time to jump on the bed. No, it's not time to run around. But actually, if they're feeling, especially toddlers, if they're feeling that, they do need to. They need to jump off the bed. They need to run around. They need to do all of this and get it out. And you'll see, it's almost when they get it out, for the kids that need this, and not all kids do, there's this moment it ends and you watch them and they are usually asleep within about 5 minutes afterwards. It is just, they've gotten it out, that window's gone down. And if it's still been dim, everything else around them has been calm, they're just like, yep, I am ready to go. That is that. So that is kind of one of those things that, you know, can calm families when they know this energy isn't a bad thing. It's not overtired, right? And that's what so many people panic about. I always say, if you're looking at overtired, it's not just energy. It's periods of almost mania, followed by the melting down, screaming, followed by mania again. That's more of what the overtired looks like than just a kid who's like, hey, I'm ready to play, because that ready to play has to do with everything else. So that is one of the things. And then psychologically speaking, some kids get very resistant at bedtime because they have had experiences. They think they're being left alone. They're scared. They try to get away from it. So sometimes I'll say to families, you know what? It's okay to put your kid to bed in a totally different room and move them after, because they just need to feel safe to fall asleep. And if that room has these associations, you work on those during the day, have positive time, maybe go in at bedtime for a little bit and then out, but they need to have that there. The other thing is to do things, you know, sleep, as we all know, is a thief. It comes in when you least expect it, but you can't invite it in, right? So the more you try to sleep, the less able you are to sleep, the more awake you get. It has to kind of sneak up on you. That was the whole thing behind counting sheep. Do something else and let sleep take over. So oftentimes the kids that are resistant, I think they struggle in part because they're trying to sleep, which then makes it harder to fall asleep. And then they feel worse and the anxiety comes out. I can't sleep. Oh my God, what's going on? And they're thinking about sleeping and it perpetuates, but they just feel weird about it. It's not, again, this conscious, they're just feeling awkward about it. So if you can do things, I've used guided meditations with a lot of kids to listen to, or just audio stories, because you can use them on your phone in the dark instead of having books that you read, but you turn it into a nice time to just lie together. And we're going to have a special story time in the dark. And I would often say to families, especially younger kids who might be resistant, no, we're not falling asleep. I want you to stay awake till the end so that we can listen to another one. And then they get to relax. And as they relax in that moment is when sleep can start to take over for them, because they don't fear that they're being forced into it. They're getting this calming, relaxing snuggle time with a grown-up, something to listen to, so to take their mind off the fact that they're supposed to go to sleep. So these are the kind of things that can make it a lot nicer. And the other thing I always say is, as you mentioned, kind of this long routine of everything to do. I am a firm believer that bedtime routine should be no more than 10 minutes max. You need a bath, that's done way earlier. Because what you want to do is see your child tired enough to welcome sleep. And when your routine is an hour long and you're getting resistance, if it's an hour long and your kid's great and you're happy with it and you're all falling asleep, that is wonderful. But when there's resistance, sometimes I think it's because we start the routine that signals sleep before they're tired. And if someone were to tell me at 8 p.m., okay, time to start getting ready for bed, I'd be like, no, that's not going to work. That's not how this goes. And that can make it worse, because at that point, they're resisting the idea of sleep, which is causing stress, which raises cortisol levels. And we're not talking about cortisol in terms of like high trauma, but cortisol just being higher than it should be, kind of in quotation marks there, whatever that is for an individual level to sleep. Just being a bit higher actually impacts sleep. It makes it harder to fall asleep, makes it harder to stay asleep. It leads to a lower quality sleep. And we do have research on that. And that is something that is important for people to know. So when all this other stuff is done earlier, have a bath earlier and then plan to get out and play a bit, even if it's then dim and whatnot. And then you're going in just for the last few things, the brushing your teeth, getting into PJs, and then snuggling in bed. Read all your books earlier. Because again, you can do audiobooks, lovely right before bed, but reading requires light. And so it again goes back to that counter of, if I'm reading all these books right before trying to go to sleep, that's going to be a problem.
So yeah, so I mean, you can do all of these things as kind of your evening ritual, but the bedtime is not going to go on for hours.
Exactly. The bedtime, and part of that like pre-bedtime may just be letting your kid play and just engage and get their energy out, get their whatever they're engaged in going on and doing. And then all the other stuff you'd make time for earlier, definitely make time for it. It's lovely to have that bonding time in the evening, but not right before bed. Like that bedtime needs to be just those last few things.
And sometimes, you know, I think people also they're lying in bed, even, you know, in the dark, and they're bored out of their mind, and the child still won't sleep. So it's also important for parents to, you know, maybe put in your headphones and listen to something so you can kind of have some nice relaxation time at the same time while you're waiting for your child to go to sleep, or the child that just keeps nursing and nursing and won't go to sleep. You know, it can be very helpful to not drive yourself crazy. And I think the other thing you talk about as well, which I think is so important to mention, is you have to not, it really affects children when you get stressed out over sleep, that they really pick up on that. And so talk a little bit about how important it is for you to calm yourself and to find something that's comfortable for you during that time.
Yeah, absolutely. So we have what's called synchrony with our kids, generally speaking. Not everyone does, but in a secure relationship and everything, we have this what's called physiological synchrony. And it is primarily related to cortisol, but they've actually identified it in other hormones as well. But it means that as one goes up, the other follows suit. And it's generally our children follow suit to us. We can follow our kids. When our babies cry, we get anxious, we get a similar quick rise. But for us, it's informative as to how to act, right? So we go up, and then that motivates us to act, and we comfort and we calm, and then we get calm, which then helps bring them down to calmness. So when we can't calm ourselves, what's happening is our baby just keeps picking up our physiological state and basically mirroring it back at us. So if you're trying to fall asleep and you are lying there thinking, oh my, I'm going to murder this child, just go the fuck to sleep, it is actually counterproductive to getting your child to go to sleep, because what they pick up, and the way I always view it is from an evolutionary perspective, one thing babies and children are exceptionally good at is reading nonverbal cues of other people, because that tells them about their world, right? They may not understand the language, they may not understand everything, but they pick up on this nuance because that's how they get to know, oh, is it a safe world? Do I need to be alert and seek proximity and cling tighter to stay safe? And that's all picked up from our nonverbal cues. So in a sense, the way I like to think about it is a child, baby or a toddler, who's lying in bed with a stressed out parent is just getting, okay, so the world's not safe today. Something is wrong out there. They don't think it's them. They're not going, oh, I'm not falling asleep, and that's why mom is seemingly pissed off. It is, this is not a safe place. So I should try and A, stay awake longer so that I can make sure I'm close to someone, and probably not fall into a deeper sleep either. My brain's going to say, okay, I've got to kind of be on high alert. And you see this in adults. When I always watched episodes of that show, I think it was Naked and Afraid or something, where these people go out to those crazy worlds and do all of that. And you saw they never slept well because there was danger. They couldn't get into that deep sleep no matter what. And days and days and days of it is really not great. But that was what their problem was, is they were not feeling safe. And when we don't feel safe, we can't go into the type of sleep that we want our babies to have. And so we are giving them those cues. So I always say to families, if you're at that stage where you're truly losing your mind, you are, and if you've got earphones, you can listen to something and calm, great. But if not, get back up. You are better off getting back up, going to a calm environment out, letting your kid play for a bit more, calming yourself, doing something. And it's usually that families think of all the things I need to be doing right now, which is what's keeping them from being able to stay calm, and go do one of them. Get it done so that when you next go back into bed with your kid to lie down, everything's okay again. But that is kind of, you know, where it goes. And I think this is where so many families feel it's not sustainable to have kids who need assistance at night, because it's taking so long that, yes, what's not sustainable is the hour every night. But when everything kind of lines up, most kids fall asleep within 5 to 10 minutes. And that should be sustainable for all of us. If we can't give our kids 10 minutes of our time to snuggle at night, we have to reevaluate what's happening in our lives and how we can give that to them. But that is what should be sustainable.
And I think it's so important also to point out that it's also very individual, that you may hear, oh, every child needs to be in bed at 7:30 at night and asleep. And for that, no, there are a wide variety of how much sleep a person needs and a child needs. They're individuals. And there are, we're going to talk a little bit later, a little bit more about personality differences, but there are some children that just, you know, they need to be part of your evening until 10 or 11 o'clock at night. You know, they, you know, you keep things as calm as possible. You get things done. You know, you can involve them in, you know, throwing socks around while you fold laundry or whatever it is, but then they're ready later than another child. And so I think that's a really important thing to remember is you have to go with what works for your family individually and your child individually.
Yeah. And we do find some of the biggest problems are when there's a mismatch between what works for the parent and what works for the child. And it's hard, but the child won't, we like to think we can just change our children, but there often has to be some give on all ends there, right? So if you have a night owl, you may have to just make that work somehow. And that is, you know, to maximize your sleep, because that's what it still comes down to, is maximizing yours as well. And when talking about bedtimes, I think it's always important to mention other cultures do not have this early bedtimes that we have. And so in cross-cultural research that looks at average bedtimes, many, for example, Asian countries, the average bedtime for children is 10 p.m. And that's average. Many go later, some go earlier, but that midpoint is 10 p.m. Now, in our culture, I've heard people say, oh my God, it's like child abuse if they go to bed that late. Well, then apparently I abuse my children all throughout their youth because they've always gone to bed late. That's always been what it is. But in other cultures, that's completely normal because everyone goes to bed together. And that is actually one of those other pieces there, is that sometimes it's very easy to get your kid to bed when you're going to bed with them. If everyone's going in together, A, as they're toddlers, they know they're not missing out on anything. B, your act of falling asleep physiologically helps drive them towards sleep too. Because as we all know, sometimes even it goes the opposite way. If you've ever snuggled your child, been tired enough, as they fall asleep, you end up accidentally falling asleep earlier than you planned and not, you know, having brushed your teeth, and you kind of wake up at 2 a.m. like, ah, I've got to, you know, do whatever I need to do to get back to sleep. But that is, it works the other direction too. And you maximize that first stretch of sleep where most of us have our deepest part of sleep the first part of the night. That is where we spend more time in that deep restorative sleep. And you can think about the mismatch. If you're not going to bed with your child, they're getting that sleep while you're watching shows, doing whatever, but then they go into a very active periods of sleep because there's so much to learn. We know we learn more during that. And they have a lot of time in active sleep, way more than we do as adults. And we're trying to get our restorative sleep. Well, they're going through their active sleep and therefore waking more frequently and needing more assistance to go down. That will make you feel horrible as you try to get down. So the more people can try and align with their kids on going to bed at the same time, I know it counters this Western notion of you must have time as a couple before bed or all this. You can still do that because your kids can play independently. Even young children can do that. But it really can help with sleep.
Absolutely. And I think there's so much of, we have to put our kids to bed so we get our time to do our chores or to have our own time. And if we can figure out ways to do that while our children are awake, you know, whether I love the idea in the article of just going out and nursing your baby while you're having a glass of wine and talking to your partner, you know, or, you know, involving your children in whatever, picking up chores you need to do, you know, I mean, give them some, you know, kitchen implements, you know, to play with in a bucket with a little thing of water on the floor while you finish the kitchen or whatever it is. If you can do things like that and get those things done or simplify so that maybe you do things in the morning, then you will feel like, oh yeah, I've gotten my time, I've gotten things done, and I'm still getting rest. And it's a different thing. It's not going to be like it was before you had children, but you can work something out that will meet everyone's needs.
And I can promise you that children will eventually go to sleep and be fine with you getting back up and having that time, but it just may not be the season at that point.
Absolutely. And also, you know, there's this idea that there must be a certain age where they have to be asleep in their own room by a certain time. Well, in many cultures, that, you know, everybody just sleeps in one big room. And, you know, even if your toddler may start out in another room, It might be great to have a mattress on the floor in your room so that when they come in, they've got a place to go. It doesn't happen. There's no switch that turns at a certain age. You know, it's a very gradual process, and it keeps kids connected and feeling good about sleep if you are able to do that.
Absolutely. 100%.
Absolutely. So we could talk about sleep forever. It's one of my favorite topics, but I do want to move on a little bit. One of the most useful aspects of your articles and your podcasts, I find, is your ability to distill and interpret current research. But can you talk a little bit about how we need to remember that a lot of research has a cultural bias, has, like, as you mentioned, the weird cultural bias. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I'll try and be a little brief on it, because it's something that I could talk for ages on and was, as you discussed earlier, kind of a major focus of an entire paper. But even so, in our culture, if you just think about, let's talk about sleep training research. There is inherent in all of that research the assumption that the end goal, the head goal, is independent sleep without interruption of a parent. And that in and of itself is only a cultural value here, but we've instilled in it. So it almost shuts the door to other research into other ways, because the end goal isn't how do we get parents more sleep, right? That's not the end goal. It's how do we get children to sleep alone without interrupting anyone else? And when we look at all research, particularly in parenting, what's the question? What is the question? How are they assessing these outcomes as good or bad? Because that's going to tell us what the cultural bias is underneath. And when you have a question that's loaded like that, how do we get children to sleep alone without interrupting parents? Then we start adding the value judgments to it, because that implies if they're waking parents, that's bad. That's a problem. And we tend to, when it's a cultural story, come up with reasons ad hoc as to why it's bad. That's why for ages, it was always, oh no, babies aren't sleeping as well. We teach them this, they need to sleep more. And if they aren't getting all this uninterrupted sleep, then it's bad for their development, it's bad for their brain, it's bad for everything. Well, we now have enough that says, actually, that's not what happens. Some even studies looking at sleep very early on find that fragmented sleep is associated with greater cognition. So there, you know, it goes in various directions, but they come up with the excuses afterwards because they're just trying to fit the cultural norm. And so we know that yes, sleep training does not improve infant sleep. That's pretty, of the studies that cover it, that's well documented. So, okay. So we've seen some people acknowledge that and say, okay, well, actually, that's not what it is. Actually, what they're doing is they're regulating their emotions. They're learning how to regulate and get back down. Now, as someone who studied emotion regulation through everything, I'm just baffled by it, because these are the same people that will remind you that your infant can't regulate during the day. This is why we need to co-regulate. But somehow at night, they're learning a skill that they can't translate any other time. But even then, you look at the research that says the moment you respond again, they go back to behaving exactly the same. Like people report if their kid gets sick and then they take them to bed and they comfort them, they have to, quote unquote, re-sleep train. And a lot of our parenting research, not just in sleep, but in views on daycare, in views on discipline, all of this is centered on these cultural ideas we have about what it means to be a good parent and what it means to have a good baby. Is what it is, because we really put our value judgments on the babies. It's not even, and then the parents by proxy, if you don't have the good baby, you're clearly not a good parent. And it's really crucial to always look deep at the research as to, and I always just say, look at it and say, okay, what if we took this research and did it in an African small hunter-gatherer tribe like the Aka? What would I expect to see? And that tells me whether or not the research is even biased, because I could look at that one and say, you know, with sleep training, they just wouldn't let you do it. They'd pretty much be like, no, thank you. That's I'm not leaving my child to sleep apart from me out in the wild. Like, no, that's not happening. So we can start to see how culture infuses the research and how it infuses the questions and therefore the findings.
Absolutely. And there's even, you know, other biases that we don't even, you know, think about. I think in the episode that you had recently talking to Dr. Woodstein, you know, you talked about how there's almost no research on LGBTQ plus parents, you know, that everything is done from a heteronormative perspective. And so if you don't do that and you just look at fathers and mothers, you don't necessarily study, oh, what is it to have two female parents or two male parents or, you know, a poly family or whatever it is. So.
Exactly. Yeah. And so looking at who is in the study, and actually the podcast episode coming out this week, we were talking about the external validity of studies. Who actually takes part? How relevant is it for everyone else? And that's a problem too, because oftentimes when we look at many parenting intervention research, you are looking at parents who perceive a problem. And we don't look at the parents who don't and say, why don't you? What are you doing that makes your discipline, sleep, daycare, whatnot work for you? And already there's that issue. And some of the findings too come down to people who subscribe to more Western-oriented beliefs tend to perceive more problems in their children and everything, and therefore seek Western-oriented solutions. So if we could switch the mind frame that they have about these Western-oriented beliefs, going back to this expectations, we might actually be able to avoid the perception of some of the problems that leads to all of these studies having to be done to fix a problem that technically doesn't exist.
It's so interesting. I mean, as one example, I think of, you know, in certain cultures, children are involved in chores and helping with the family from a very early age. They're not expected to do it well, but it's just repeated exposure. So if you have a Western study looking at why children won't do chores, if you tried to do that in another culture, say in Guatemala or something, they would look at you like you had two heads, like, of course, children do this, you know? So exactly. Very biased in so many ways. So.
Yeah. And that's what I always love about anthropology and why I read it, because so many anthropologists have actually brought these questions and talked to other cultures, and they get these fantastic answers. You know, I can't remember who it was, but someone brought the question of how much, I think it was Cecilia Tomori, but I could be wrong, but, you know, how much does your baby wake at night? Just the question of that. And I believe it was Mayan culture. And they just didn't get the question. They were like, what are you talking about? How much does your baby wake? I don't know. Like, why would I even be tracking this? Like, why would anyone count the number of times their baby wakes up at night? Like, that's just, it was so unfathomable to them that they just couldn't even answer the question. That a question that many of us would be like, well, okay, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, I guess about 5 times. And treat it as a simplified question that to another culture makes no sense whatsoever.
Absolutely. So I want to pivot a little bit because we talked a little bit earlier about our lack of support in a lot of Western cultures. So, you know, parenting in Western cultures is often very difficult due to this lack of support. So can you talk about the concept of allocare, how we were meant to share parenting with others, and maybe share some ideas on how to create your own village, even when you don't live near extended family? I actually, when my husband and I decided to have children, we actually made a point of moving back near my parents because we felt like that was important to have that support. But not everybody can do that. That's a very privileged ability to be able to do something like that. So what are some other ideas, and why is allocare so important?
And I'll say my children were born in Vancouver, 3,000 kilometers or 4,000 kilometers away from all of our family back in Ontario. So we didn't have that extended network of help or anything. So it is definitely something many people face, but I was still doing my dissertation. I couldn't just up and leave and transfer. And I had stepson that was there who was young and in school and all of it. So there's a lot of considerations. So there's so many reasons. And some people may not want to be close to their family. If you were raised a certain way, that's something you may not want, that kind of support. So you need to look elsewhere. So if we start with the idea of allocare, it is really just the idea that lots of other people help raise our kids. And we need to view that as normal. And I think one of the weird things about our weird culture is that we have it, but we don't talk about it in that way. So many kids go to daycare. And if you go to daycare, you are actually sending your children to other caregivers who spend a large amount of time caring for them, being there for them, et cetera. And that's important to acknowledge. But because of how we structure it here, we like to treat them as just daycare workers. They do not have, we believe they don't have the profound impact on our kids that they do. And so I think that's one of the first really crucial pieces to think about, is that we do all have AlloCare. We use it to some form. Whoever you get to care for your child is there. The difference is, because we now treat them as others, and because they are frankly paid workers as opposed to others, AlloCare typically has someone who's part of your, whether you're looking at a tribe for certain groups, a part of your family, part of your village, who have a vested interest in the child's well-being outside of their paycheck. And that vested interest is so important, because how they treat the child and how they consider the child is going to be through that lens of, I want to see this child excel. When we see other cultures, we see that in many hunter-gatherer tribes, babies spend 40% of their time away from mom. But it's in lots of little doses, going back to that back and forth and back and forth. It's not 8 hours straight a day, but lots of people help care for the baby. And because they have the baby's well-being at heart, they don't then say, drop off and leave it with me and we're going to deal with it. Baby gets upset, they might try to comfort. And if not, they go back to mom, say, here you go. You know, this is what's needed. So they have, the end goal for the child is the best possible development for them. And mothers have had tons of help being able to raise children. They are not expected to do it all on their own. That's just an asinine expectation. And there's tons of people around. So we talk about that circle of people, but if we get too far out from that circle, like our workers, they are doing what the job requires, but at the end of the day, they don't 10 years down the line go, oh, I wonder how Jimmy's doing. Is he, you know, taking care of, how's school going? That doesn't happen. And yet you think about a smaller group where you have all these people, grandparents who care. They do care. They do want to know, and they want to follow it up for as long as possible. And that's the kind of care that our kids really are used to receiving, right? It's this from people who care about them. And so when you talk about creating that village, it's not saying don't use daycare. Lots of people find wonderful daycares, but look at the quality of that daycare, what it means to you. Some people find that getting a nanny or an occasional babysitter or shared nannyship to be more helpful, because again, that one-on-one is easier to build that relationship and easier to have that kind of care that our kids are used to having. And if you have a nanny, even if you're at work, they could bring them to you in the middle of the day for a nurse or something else. There's other practical reasons as well. But if not even that, then it's about finding friends that share beliefs and creating your own family. And I go back to what Dr. Woodstein said about a lot of people in LGBTQ families have learned, because their families were not supportive, that family is what you make of it. It's who you make it to be. And so it doesn't have to be your biological family. You can create your family based on people that share values and share the ability to care for your kids in a way that you would want. And it may not be, you may have daycare some of the time, and you may have a friend that you feel comfortable sending your kid over to play with theirs for 3 hours. And that is your break and your time, but you know they're going to care for your child in a way to you, in the way that you would, or as close to as you would as possible. No one's going to always care for them the way you would, but they are going to have their best interests fully at heart.
Absolutely. And I think it's so important that you talk about making your own village with friends, because, and neighbors are, it's another thing. Sometimes people like myself, who I'm actually basically an introvert, it's tough because you have to kind of go outside your comfort zone. You have to go and find maybe support groups, you know, LH League meetings or, you know, hiking groups or whatever it is. You have to find people that, you know, have maybe children similar ages, or even just stop people in that have strollers that are walking around with carriers or strollers in your neighborhood and say, let's get together. Let's have a parent group. And eventually you find your kind of tribe, and then you can start spending time with your child, but again, it's in small doses, like you said, where you spend time together at their house and you get to know their child and they get to know your child. Maybe you could even like switch off, you know, hanging out together while you do chores at each other's house or whatever it is, or a group you get together. And then eventually your children get to know these people, they get to know the other children so that you can drop them off for a few hours here and there. And that, you know, or perhaps there's grandparents in your neighborhood that don't live close to their grandchildren and they would love to get to know your children. And you could have time, you know, just sitting in their backyard, having a cup of tea, and they get to know your children and eventually they can go to this surrogate grandparent. And, you know, it's so important to really, you know, put yourself out there, because you just, if you're trying to do it all yourself, it's just going to drive you crazy.
It's impossible. And I'll say, you know, when you say mentioning people in neighborhoods, one of my greatest allo care people to my daughter in Vancouver was we met at Whole Foods, just at a walk, and then didn't see each other for ages, then ran into each other again a couple months later at a Starbucks. And then we were like, you know what, we should really just exchange numbers and go from there. And that was the beginning of a beautiful friendship. So there really are different ways that you can do it. And it really is so, so nice to have. And I had another one that we met at a homeschool group who became essential, because when my son got sick and we had to go to the hospital for him at one point, she took my daughter and was there till, you know, 11 p.m. at night, because we were in the ER the whole time with him. So it was, you know, instead of having that younger child traipse along for all day while we're having medical tests done and everything, it was, she was well cared for and we could focus on what we needed to.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So I know we're almost out of time, and we could just talk forever, but I wanted to briefly just ask you about something you've done a lot of work on. Can you talk a little bit about the concept of the orchid and the dandelion child? What is that? And what are some things parents might need to know if they're raising an orchid? And where can they go find out more information about that? Because that does really affect so much of what we've talked about today.
Absolutely. Yeah. This is that temperament bit. And we use the term, I'll first say, we use the term orchid dandelion, but it's not really just two buckets, right? We're talking about a distribution of kids who are more orchid, a little mix, and more dandelion. So they're extremes. But what this references is that terminology came up from Dr. Thomas Boyce. But another term used to represent the same thing was called biological sensitivity to contact environment, and or differential susceptibility to the environment. And that was Jay Belsky's work as well. So it's been going on for quite a while. But the idea is some children, like dandelions on one end, really are not that affected by their environment. And we see it in studies, and it's always hard for us to fathom, but these are kids who may have an insecure attachment. They may have some struggles going on. They may face poverty or something that's out there, and they seem to just turn out okay. They just kind of do what they're going to do, and they go on their merry way. And it's important here that we're talking about normal negative things. There are extreme traumas of extreme abuse, war, et cetera. These are not within that realm, but within the realm of what we would consider normal events that happen to people around the world and throughout history and time, they're the ones that are going to be pretty hardy to it. You know, you have a famine one year, as long as they make it through, they're not really negatively affected by it in the long run. On the opposite side of the spectrum here are the orchids, and hence the term dandelion. Dandelions grow almost anywhere under almost any condition. On the opposite side is the orchid. And like an orchid flower, they require a very specific environment to thrive. But when they get that right environment, they do great. But when they're, you know, considered one of the most beautiful flowers, they thrive, but just slightly off of that environment, they tend to die. So I always love this story Lindsay Hookway shared when we were talking about orchids and dandelions on a chat with her on Instagram. She had an orchid as a kid, and they had it in this one spot in the house, and it was beautiful and it thrived. And then something happened. It got moved about a foot away and it died. Within like a week, it was whatever the sunlight was just not enough, not everything. That little change was the problem. And when we look at the research, what we're seeing is that some children, and this is why I say it's a continuum, because some are more or less affected by their environment, but they're affected by the good and the bad. So Fascinatingly, Thomas Boyce and all his research finds that orchids who are, you know, these ones susceptible, show up disproportionately in families where there's a lot of struggles, where, you know, we have more problems, but also disproportionately in the most sensitive and responsive families. And it's thought that because there is a genetic component, and Jay Belsky, I'm trying to remember the term he used on the podcast when we were talking about this recently, but it's like a genetic profile, right? You have a genetic risk, closer or less, depending on that, it interacts with the environment you're in to say, do I need to be susceptible? And the thought was always that this variation was happening within families. It's survival of the fittest, right? If you're in a great environment, you want to be an orchid because you will thrive. If you're in a crappy environment, you may not want to be an orchid, or just a regular environment, you're better off going the other way. Why negative so much is that there's often a sense of they have to respond to the threat. So even in a negative environment, having an orchid could be beneficial because they will pick up the threat for everyone else. And so what this looks like, the primary biological factor here is that they are very sensitive to threat, and therefore their stress levels go beyond what other kids do. So they actually ascertain who is an orchid and who is a dandelion based on how kids' cortisol responses go to stressors. And for most kids, their stress in the, especially in the first 3 years or so, really doesn't rise very much to many things. Like it goes up a bit, but it actually takes a lot to get a stress response from children. They seem to have this buffer, likely because neurologically, you don't want them being flooded with cortisol all the time. It's not good for the developing brain. But when they do that, so that's what you do. And then the second bit is for orchids, when they get it, their stress is through the roof when they get stressed. But sorry, what I meant by the second bit is they get buffered by us. So whereas other kids just seem to not need that buffer, the orchid, when we are sensitive and responsive and provide all of that, they can face those stressful situations and we keep that stress from rising. We are the ones that help them stay safe. So a lot of the behaviors that we see associated with this is they may be the baby that has to cling to mom all the time, doesn't like being put down. They do seem to be very acutely aware of the world around them. And sometimes people say, you know, if they have an orchid right from birth, they're like, this kid just came out eyes wide open and taking everything in, and they see it. It's different than other babies. And importantly, though, some kids become orchids later. It actually goes, you know, how kids respond to this sensitivity is totally variable over time. And that's Jay Belsky's newest work, was kind of finding that when they looked at kids who were susceptible at a young age, they were able to follow them up in at adolescence. And although a lot of people stayed the same, we had crisscrosses. There were kids who were not at all susceptible or sensitive or orchids when they were younger that suddenly were, and those that had been that weren't. So whatever had happened in the environment kind of shifted how they were manifesting that susceptibility to the environment. But these are kids that just, they need the most responsive care for us. And that seems to be what is that best environment for them, is very sensitive, very responsive. You know, they're not the kids that are going to do well with sleep training. They're not the ones that will necessarily be dropped off at daycare and just adapt like that. Other research that looked at some of that found that these are the kids who are much more, their behavior matches their emotions more. So some kids, when we look at the daycare transition, for example, a lot of kids actually do still get stressed out. That's actually one of the big stressors for young children. And it can cause a high cortisol reaction. Most dandelions, however, will still have it, but they do adapt. They just don't behave anymore that way. The orchids just keep crying. they will let you know they're upset. They don't settle well because it seems their threshold for kind of going into that state of too much is just very low. So they cross that line regularly.
Absolutely. And it's so important, I think, for parents to remember that, you know, your friend who has the quote unquote easy baby or the easy child, you may not have that dandelion child. You may have, I had probably two orchids. And I can tell you, it was quite difficult. And I sometimes wondered, what was I doing wrong? My kids were so intense. But I tried to be as responsive as possible. I wasn't perfect in any stretch of the imagination, but they have actually thrived and turned out very well as adults. So, I know that whatever I did, they still are going to have their struggles, but I know that I gave them the best I could by that responsiveness. And I think sometimes it gets very difficult if you get a parent that has a cultural belief in such as tough love, something like that. You just have to, crack down on this child, and they may not do at all well with that. Maybe a dandelion will do fine, but others, they need much more connection and responsiveness.
And when we talk about long-term outcomes, I just want to add this because I think it's important to help reframe. If you think you can get it out of them, these are kids that look like they're doing great all the time. So like when Thomas Boyce talks about the orchid, he has a talk on YouTube that it was really lovely. How he came about this was because of his sister. He wanted to understand why his sister, who was the most brilliant in the family and lovely and funny, she ended up committing suicide. Years of mental health struggles, everything. And he's like, but I know we didn't grow up in the same family. No one does. There's always that differences, but we did grow up in the same family. The small variations in how we all engage with our parents are very small relative to the interfamily, between family differences going on. So this is where it comes out, is that they are at risk for later health problems. They're far greater health problems and later mental health problems. When we talk about anxiety, depression, bipolar, all sorts of stuff, they are actually at much higher risk of that. And so the ability to kind of get over our cultural beliefs to parent that particular child in front of you, we're talking about a really important distinction here. That is something that is worth doing because we don't want our kids to, end up with a lifelong struggle with mental health issues. We don't want them facing higher risks of heart attacks because their cortisol system has been stressed so regularly that their body ends up kind of breaking down from it. So these are the things, there's actually like real reasons. It's not saying they're going to get a better job. We're talking about fundamental elements of well-being.
Absolutely. And, my oldest still does have some struggles with, anxiety and depression, but I feel like she knows now how to handle it. We did everything we could to support her. She goes to a therapist. It's so important that you connect and maintain that connection and help them understand that you're there for them and that you support them and that they don't have to do it all on their own. Whereas other kids might just be fine with whatever, so.
Exactly. Yeah. And what you said earlier about, you weren't perfect. I always caution families of orchids, you don't want to be perfect. Mm-hmm. That is not you. This is not about perfect parenting. This is about responsive. And we can mess up a million times as responsive parents. And as long as every single one of those million times we apologize, we own it, we don't put it on our kid, they will be okay. They can, if you're making the same mistake over and over, you got to examine what it is. But there's so many mistakes to be made as parents. We're going to make them all. And that is where our kids and our orchids in particular are forgiving and understanding, but we can't put it on them. We have to own when we make the mistake, and we don't have to worry about being perfect. And I think actually for orchids, it's very good to see us make mistakes and own up to them, because some of that anxiety later tends to come out in perfectionism. Absolutely. So when they see, I don't have to be perfect, other people make mistakes too, it's actually a really valuable lesson for them.
I think it's absolutely one of the best gifts you can give your child is to say, hey, I made a mistake. What can I do? I'm sorry. It's so important to model those kinds of things, because perfectionism is quite a curse. I'm a recovering perfectionist myself. So.
I hear you. You're not alone.
Tracy Castles, this has just been amazing. I'm so thrilled that we finally got to talk. Again, Dr. Tracy Castles is the founder of Evolutionary Parenting. She has an amazing website at www.evolutionaryparenting.com and a fantastic podcast that you can find pretty much anywhere called Evolutionary Parenting. I highly recommend it. When you're done listening to this podcast, please go listen to hers. Thank you so much, Tracy. This has been a delight.
Oh, thank you so much, Mary. It's been truly wonderful.
Absolutely. Thank you again.
If you enjoyed this episode, you can join the discussions on our Facebook and Instagram pages. To hear more, subscribe for free on the podcast app on your smartphone. We are available on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, and all of your favorite podcast platforms. If you would like to offer feedback or suggest a guest, email us at untaming.podcast@gmail.com.